All right. Thank you for a good introduction, a good reminder of what we're here for. All right. So, unfortunately, I did not yet get to listen to the recording of Vinny last week. I'm assuming that he did a good job. It's just that I don't know exactly what he did a good job of. So, because of that, there's not going to be any direct tie-in between this week and last week. I'm going to assume that Vinny covered some of the stuff that I gave him to cover, and we're going to move on. And so that's where we are. So this week we're going to focus primarily on communication. Here's the big idea. That way if you need to leave early or you get bored or you zone out later on, you've got the main idea for the morning. The main idea is this, that everything that you know, that you believe, that you understand, everything that goes into the mental part of who you are dies with you, unless you pass it on. Now just let that settle in. That means that all the wisdom that you have accumulated, and I hope you've accumulated some wisdom, some the easy way, some the hard way, but we've all accumulated wisdom, and all of that is going to pass away with you unless you become a good communicator. So here's one of the things, it's not in your notes, but there's a couple of objectives that every person has when they communicate. And the rest of the morning, we're going to talk about various reasons why it's necessary to communicate, how we can communicate. So the first thing that anybody has to do, if they want to say something, is hope that the other person is going to receive it. All right, so there's a number of reasons why someone might not receive something that you said. We'll look at a few examples later on, but what do you think? What are some of the reasons why someone might not receive what you said? Okay, they can't hear you. All right?
Selective hearing.
Selective hearing. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, so there's something in the way of a firewall between them and what you want to share with them. They're not ready to receive it yet. Or they're not interested in receiving it. Now we're getting to the major hurdles. Some of these are technical. Some of these are major hurdles. So come back to the premise. Everything that is inside of you that's good, and we're going to assume that there's some good stuff inside of you, dies with you unless you find a way to pass it on. Here should be a lingering, haunting question. What do you do about the person who is not ready to receive something good? Do you just write them off and move on? Or do you need to find a better approach? So we'll hold on to that idea. Think about that for a little while. Are there any other reasons why someone might not receive something? Okay, that which brings us to the next thing, actually, which is that you hope that they're going to understand it.
What did he say?
Understand. Now, a while ago, when we did a series about how to teach things, I suggested an illustration that apparently was well received by some of you. I said that your purpose in achieving understanding inside another person's mind is for you to take the thing that you know, disassemble it into pieces, deliver those pieces, and help the person to reassemble those pieces in the same way inside their mind. And the illustration I used was, suppose that you pictured a house in your mind. Complete, sided, painted, trimmed on the inside, furnished, and that's what lived inside your head and was the idea that you wanted to share. Delivering a load of lumber to your neighbor and saying, here's the house, is not enough. They might have all of the components necessary to build the house, but it still doesn't construct the house and decorate the house inside their mind. Understanding is not complete until what lives in your mind lives in theirs, as closely as possible. Now understand, they don't have the same frames of reference to link your knowledge as you do. But your job is not complete until they understand. Okay, what's next? In the long term, you hope that they're going to remember what you've said. I mean, it almost goes without saying, but if you pour hours of your life into other people, communicating wisdom to them, communicating understandings that you believe are essential to them, and they forget it all, what was the point? Now, and you can say, well, they're just not serious about it, or they're distracted, or they're whatever it is. Remember, this is your responsibility. You own the responsibility of getting the knowledge that is inside of you into them, so long as they're willing. And even if they're not willing, but you believe it's in their best interest, then you owe yourself and you owe them a significant effort at working around the problems. If they're not ready to receive, if they don't understand. And what do we do to help them remember?
Write it down.
Well, that's what they would do. That's what I might do so that they would have access to it. That, in essence, is what the scriptures are. They are the recorded wisdom that is... That's a great illustration. You can't imagine, as a matter of fact, the number of times that I have learned just enough Spanish to get by with no one to practice it with. In a year's time, I've got to go back and look up two words just so I can figure out how I can say hello. That, what a wonderful illustration. Yeah. And finally, and this will help with the memory process, you hope that they're going to take action on something. And among other things, remember at one of the four things that you're striving to do that you see in your world as a leader is there are things that you notice that need to be preserved. That means that your job or your goal, if you're actually a serious leader, is not just to get the idea from you to them. You want them to understand how to pass it on to a subsequent generation. You've heard me use this illustration numerous times, but the real test of whether you've been a good parent is when you look at your grandkids. It's your grandkids that reveal whether you have communicated things in a way that stuck with your kids, and they prized them and valued them enough so that they begin to communicate them to their grandchildren. And as you watch your grandchildren grow up, then you've got a good idea as to how well you've done. All right. So what we say is, we have said this repeatedly, everything that you do in this world will be done for, with, or through other people. That's your motive, that's your impetus for great communication. Because if you need to work with other people, how many of you have not had contact with another human being for the last 6 days before you came here? Right? Right, it's a stupid question. But is it? We try, right? Honestly, we try. The greatest times in my life are when I'm alone in a car for miles on end. It's wonderful. And then somebody picks up or calls me and it breaks the whole magic. Yup, we try. But since everything we do is going to be done in connection with or for or using the help of other people, if we don't master communication, honestly, how effective are we going to be in life? All right, so my first illustration here, and I'm going to use information and illustration together. I want to remind you the reason we call this Life School. It is the convergence of the lives that we have to live in this day and time with scriptural application. So over the course of the last couple of years, I have read extensively and heard repeatedly about what we're going to call the large block of humanity that is gradually going to be replaced by intelligent machines. In other words, artificial intelligence, computers that are able to derive their own conclusions, automation, robotics, is going to displace a significant number of people, even in this country. Now, incidentally, this is not just a piece of trivia. That's why I say this is useful information as well as well as illustration. No, we are not. There are large numbers of people in this country and other parts of the world that are not going to have work. To illustrate this a little bit more pointedly, it has been the natural progression throughout time that as societies develop, they push offshore their less desirable work. And the first thing that happens is colonies produce the raw materials that go to the more developed countries. Gradually, as countries develop further, they start to push off their manufacturing. We've seen that. But here's the next trend. The Chinese actually started to push their manufacturing offshore to less expensive places to make it until very recently. And they've arrived at a new conclusion. That with enough capital, you can build enough robots, and with enough robots, you can displace human labor altogether. And so they are now the biggest producers and users of robotic technology in the world. Now that should unsettle us just a little bit. No, they don't.
Like you said, the people suffer.
Now, lest you think that this is somebody else's problem, I did a little bit of math here on your paper. You're going to work about, I mean, this is if you follow the typical cycle and retire at 65, you're going to work for about 40-some years. So if you were born in, what is the year that I put here, 1994, you're about halfway through your work cycle. I started work in 1994, I'm sorry, you're about halfway through your work cycle. Think back to the year 1994. Do you even remember what was going on in 1994? I honestly, do you? Okay, good. How much has changed since then? How much about the way things are done has changed? What technology wasn't available that is available now? How many people have been displaced work-wise between then and now? The pace of change is only going to accelerate. If you have young children in your home, if you have grandchildren, you should take seriously the idea of sharing with them for their own financial security's sake. And it's okay to talk about money once in a while here. You should help them to understand what it will take to excel in this whole new world that we're entering. I just read and started into another book, which got me thinking about this whole thing, which is why it's now the illustration that we're talking about. The author suggested that one of the things that works against our being able to master these complex things is that we're now distracted people. That we can no longer spend intense amounts of time learning things that require what he calls deep work. That we look at something for 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes and then we're distracted by something else and we then open up another screen on our computer or scroll into something else on our phone or whatever and we look at and pretty soon we're off to the races in a different direction. And he uses this illustration. It was really an insightful illustration. He talks about a fella who goes to school, gets an advanced degree in economics, and he goes to work for a bank. The bank puts him about the business of developing spreadsheets that they can do final loan analysis. In other words, before a loan officer finally pulls the trigger on something, there has to be somebody who does the research in the background to determine, is this fellow credit worthy? Does this look like a good risk? He said, well, in a very short period of time, I got tired of spending hours and hours every day of my life having gone to school for 6 years after I got out of high school. I've been going to school for an additional 6 years to get trained on this. I thought I was worth more than being able to work Excel spreadsheets all day long. There had to be something more to life. So he figured out how to reduce these spreadsheets down to formulas where in an hour a day he could do everything that he was expected to do in 8 hours a day, and he realized that this was his future. That's all he was going to be here. That all his grand dreams of what he would be someday if he got this great education had been reduced to this. He said, there has to be something more for me. He decided, exactly like we're talking about, that he would learn the language of machines, he would learn how to do the work that the future man was going to have to do. So he said, I went home, I had enough saved up, I quit my job, and I thought, I'm going to teach myself code. He said, and I was shocked. He said, I couldn't concentrate for more than 30 minutes at a time, and this stuff was difficult to learn. He said, I had to put myself on a computer fast. And this was not some spiritual journey he was on. This was literally, I cannot concentrate for long enough to learn these complex things unless I do this. He said, gradually I got to the point where I could lock myself in my room for 6 hours at a time. I wouldn't even give myself permission to test my code on a computer for fear of the fact that if I once turned the computer on, I'd be distracted. So I committed to memory the lines of code that were needed, wrote them on little 3x5 cards, and later, when I came out of seclusion, then I put them to the test. So in the course of a year's time, he taught himself a number of complex codes. He said, but without the capability to seclude himself away, to do the deep work of thinking through and learning complex things, he would have failed at this. And so this, the author suggests, is one of the three skills that is going to be necessary in the future. People who can communicate with intelligent machines, who understand how they work, who can repair them, who can write the code that will tell them what to do. They will succeed. The best of the best at any field that is in demand will succeed. That means the best of the best cooks, the best of the best musicians, the best of the best, even in, and I'm going to use a general term here, even in church world. What has changed about church in the last 30 years?
Technology.
See, at my fingertips, I have access to the best teaching pastors in the world. Think about that. I mean, 30 years ago, I could have turned the radio on, and if I hunted around for a while, I could find what? Well, whoever was on that hour. But if I didn't want to listen to whoever was on that hour, I was pretty much out of luck. Today, I have access to all that. So ask yourself, what does the local church have to offer that makes it unique and causes it to float to the top of all of the others? How do we do community well? That's one of the things that's going to be missing in people's lives. How do we do community well? How do we do community so excellently that other people aren't having their needs met wherever they do community, and they start to come to where we do community because they feel connected? So again, even in church world, things are going to change. They're going to continue to change. Being, number one, being able to communicate with intelligent machines. Number two, being able to master complex and difficult things so that you become the best of the best at whatever you do. And here's the third one, and this is particularly troubling. If you have enough money that you are the capitalist, that you can finance either of these other two endeavors. So if you have enough money, you are guaranteed to succeed if you do the deep work of studying and evaluating who to invest in. Right, we all know people. Do you know anybody that's ever made an investment, lost a lot of money, and we wouldn't call it an investment anymore? Yeah, we would call it a total loss. I said, do we know somebody? I didn't ask you for personal confession. That can be embarrassing. All right? Again, where does that come from? From careful and thoughtful evaluation that takes time.
Or the other way around. Learn from this.
Oh, that. Yeah, if you have more money left over or can make enough more, then you can reinvest after you've learned the hard way. All right, two components. This was information. This was illustration. I hope that something that I said was sticky enough that it connects with you and you take it out of here. Because if you didn't receive it, understand it, remember it, and then decide what action you're going to take on it, guess what I just did? Thank you. Yeah, but that's exactly right. That's what I did. I just wasted my time. But incidentally, I'm not the only one. You wasted your time sitting through all that too. So we all wasted our time. So unless what I've said connects with you in such a way, what is the action that you might take when you leave here? And that's what you need to be thinking about. Oh, unquestionably, but if I believe, are there things in your life that you just definitely know that you want your family to take with them on their journey through life? What if they're not interested? Do you still believe it's important to them? I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not a challenge. We're not saying, look, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that we struggle to communicate with other people because they're not buying what we're selling.
Well, it is different.
Okay.
And the world is really heading towards technological Armageddon.
Okay. I'm glad you're bringing it up in that light because I do want the illustration to stick. But here's the thing, if we have children, if we have grandchildren, we want to communicate important values, and we need to make sure that we understand this process such that we can watch them take action on something. Because if they don't take action on something, so you're saying that when you walk in here, that in old days you would have been tempted to hit me, but now you attempt to hug me and I rebuff you. You would not have walked in here. Okay.
I was asked to leave a church because there was an issue.
Hitting people?
Or you were hugging
people? No, I was hitting.
Well, I can see where that'd not be conducive to church culture. If you went around and hit a lot of the people there, they might not come back.
So God did a work in my heart, and now in the beginning, I had to decide I was going to hug instead of hit. For me, it's part of my recovery. But now what I see is my son hugs Tim's kids. And when they leave, they say, hey, where's my hug? Here they're 10 and 11 years old, and they don't know why. They don't need to know why, but they naturally do it.
All right, we're going to come back to this because there's a whole section in our notes devoted to this, but I want you to pay close attention to something that he just did. He shared a lot of information about his struggle. He wants his children to remember the information about the struggle. But he did something else that makes it likely that they'll remember it and act on it. He used that simple, alliteral phrase. Hug instead of hit. That sticks. I want you to hug people instead of hit people. That's short enough. It's memorable enough that can actually be embedded into somebody's psyche and they will start to act that way. That was a good piece of communication. Now, maybe it was unintended. We stumble upon things all the time that turn out to be pretty good. I'm not even sure we stumble upon them. They're probably in there already and they just come out.
There are things that when you're talking about how somebody remembers, and oftentimes what Vinny will remember something through versus what somebody else can versus what somebody else will remember is defined by their background. I may not remember something because it's just to me it's not interesting, it might be irrelevant, it doesn't pertain to me, so I'll choose what I want to remember. And I mean, I'm pushing 50 and now I tell people like, look, hey, this is full. Now I've got to choose to delete files because something in, something out. Something's got to go if I'm to remember that. So now I've got to go, oh, okay. If I'm filling my head with garbage or just nonsense for this number of hours, I better use the same number of hours to push that nonsense out and to hold on to something that I need. You know what I mean? I mean, it just...
All right. Now, this brings us to the next point. And that's the point of choice that we've talked about already. You can't force people to embrace anything. You can't force people to accept it. So within the confines of free will, how do you communicate important ideas in ways that will make them want to receive it and consider it for long enough so that they can understand it? You're wagging your finger at me again already.
Because they talk about social engineering. You can make somebody choose. You can walk somebody right into the worst thing in the world because you just distract them with so much other junk and they'll all credit it.
My premise.
People will starve in the future. People will starve in the future because they don't know how to farm, they don't know how to hunt, they don't know how to hunt. They're going to starve because they believe that the robot will feed them. Why? Because it spits out food.
He's really taking this technology thing seriously, which is good. Okay, I need to bring this around now so that there is some sort of, because there are people here who are going to say, I came here for some spiritual content and I'm not sure I got any. All right, I think this is actually spiritual content because it informs the whole of our life. However, let's bring this around a little bit. When I communicate, I need to respect people's right to choose. That means I can't force it on them. We see how that works with kids. You can force a child while they're in your home to do certain things. You can force them to say certain things. You cannot force somebody to believe certain things, and you'll see that played out as soon as they leave home. So your job is not just to produce action devoid of this. You've got to create a belief in their own mind, and that might actually be another word that we need to add to there, is a belief somewhere in there that this is a good thing for them to retain so that they act on it. So where would we put the word belief? It would probably be here. Although some might argue that it should be up here. I didn't hear that.
Relativity, like something this will relate to your life because...
Yeah. So you want to add another one? Okay. My simple 4-point outline is getting all messed up now. But no, but it's a great example because your son is giving you feedback about somehow your results there. that thus far, with the, based on the feedback that you're getting from him, he's not ready to take action on this voluntarily yet, right?
He's not receiving it because he doesn't understand. He's not gonna, he doesn't feel like he needs to commit it to memory. He's not going to take action on it because he doesn't feel like it's relevant.
Okay, and so sometimes we accept that we're just planting what we call seeds. I mean, that sounds almost lame, but we're planting seeds that they're going to understand later once they have more of their own life experience to mix it with. Right? We've all heard things when we were younger that we didn't get or we didn't believe, or, well, that might be true for you, but it's not true for me. And then that thing happens. Whatever that thing happens, and it's like, oh yeah, that's what he was talking about. Oh, I get it now.
Well, and sometimes, I think it was Paul, he used to make understanding. We say sort of like, you know, capiche, understand? Yeah, that's ask it as a question. And Paul would make a command. Understand. Well, understand what? Like, I can't. You're telling me to understand as a command. Understand what? I don't even know what you're talking about. And I think that that command to understand made people go, what? And I think oftentimes, if we can make them start to ask the question, understand what? See what? If we can sort of fundamentally make people sort of wonder, what are you talking about?
And all of that lives within the realm of what we could refer to, as we did earlier, as deep work. The sort of undistracted, reflective thought or learning that can only take place absent distractions. Because when you're left with your own thoughts and something amusing comes up that could distract you, you could be tempted to just veer off into whatever is more interesting at that in that second. Did you have your hand up?
I did.
Would you like to?
The thing is, as we're sharing about how we go from this guy to others, do we live a life that people want what we have? Or are we doing it to the point where people just know that that's what we're about? And that motivates them. It pricks their hearts to want what we have. Versus we're going around trying to sell Avon and Amway to people. Versus our life reflects this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. And it, there are many people, I know an evangelist here in town that I will not go again with to evangelize people at community events. This guy was so embarrassing to what the Bible says, to who Jesus is, to his character, but he's trying to save people from hell. That's not what motivates my heart to share the gospel with anybody. And it's, you know, it's...
Yeah, because there's a truth there. We don't want people to go to hell. But the greater truth is there's a great God to know that has a great life for you.
But I'll have people ask all the time, why did you do that? And it's, you know, I'm certainly not a good example of a Christian, but I want to be an example of what being a Christian is about. People would see it and be, hey, you know, this guy's at this house doing the exact same thing I saw him doing at church. I'm not cussing at my kids. I'm not beating my wife, whatever it would be. But so often we think it's only to take the Bible and to go out. But it's also when we're actually doing it, people want what we have. The opportunities I have to text people during the week, it takes me like 4 seconds to type up a text. But it's because I want that communication. That person doesn't necessarily have, but is something I'm drawn to.
So I'm only one of 50,000 people that you text every week, so I shouldn't feel special anymore. Is that what you're saying? It's a joke, Vinny.
But all right. Knowing that, living out loud.
Okay, I want to take us back to the Genesis story early on. I just love the early chapters of Genesis for their... their explanation about human nature. Let's just say that. So we're gonna turn to the fourth chapter of Genesis, and then we're gonna back up a few verses just so that we bring this into context. Is everybody done with this list? Does anybody need to capture that? Well, too late. It's gone. Okay, so. You can read the latter part of chapter 3, but you understand what's happened. Most of us have heard this story repeatedly. So having confronted Adam and Eve about the fact that Eve has eaten, Eve has shared with, and God recognizes that having eaten from this tree, that they now have a capacity to understand the difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. They have this capacity, and then depending on the translation that you have, it's either worded as a full sentence or almost like an interrupted sentence, and God says, as if He is reflecting for a moment, off to the side. So they now have the knowledge of good and evil, and if I leave them in this place, they'll have access to the tree of life. Some translations finish the sentence, and God decides that they need to be moved out of the garden. Now, there's several reasons for this. First off, they failed in their job of stewarding the garden. That was their job, their one and only job. Care for this garden. Keep it safe from outside influences. Did they keep it safe from outside influences? No, they allowed the outside influences to influence them. And therefore, they had demonstrated that they were susceptible to outside influences that could corrupt the garden. Now, we've already said that the garden was, we'll say, God's chosen favorite place. If God came to earth for a vacation, God stayed at the Garden of Eden, if you will. It says that after He made the whole earth, He creates this special place that is His, that He shares with His caretakers, His stewards. And we assume that ultimately they're going to go out, it's part of God's plan, they're going to leave the garden, they're going to go out, and they're going to colonize and gardenize the rest of the world. But before they have the chance to do that, they stray. And so God places cherubims to guard the garden, right? That we're relieved of that responsibility, and mankind is driven out of the garden. So we start out here with God and man together in the garden. So Act 2, man is driven out of the garden into the rest of the world. But here's the interesting thing. Let's pick up this at chapter 4. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, He did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. So the first thing you notice is, it's not just the offering. There's something going on besides the offering. As a matter of fact, the explanation that many of us usually got was that one was a blood offering and one was a grain offering, and the blood offering really was the acceptable one, the grain offering wasn't. But it doesn't say that God's passing judgment only on the offering. Look at what is listed first. It's the individual that He's passing judgment on and saying, there's something about your attitude that's not right. It's not what you've brought me that's not right necessarily. It's the way you've brought it. You can maybe tease out a little bit more information because it just says that Cain brought an offering of grain, whereas Abel brought something of the firstborn. Higher stakes, greater risk. But whatever it is, notice that God has followed them out of the garden. And that's pretty remarkable. God has followed them out of the garden, and it seems that there is some interaction that's taking place between God and Cain. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." So God gives Cain space to rethink things. He not only gives him space, but He demonstrates favor that he doesn't have to. He actually gives Cain some guidance as to how he might rethink. And He gives him a warning about what's going to happen if he doesn't. So look at all the emotions again that are brewing in Cain's mind. So we jump back up. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. So God confronts it. Now Cain said to his brother, Abel, and we don't know how many days pass while this is going on. How many days does it take you to work yourself into a good fit of rage so that you're ready to act? A couple hours, okay? How many days does it take you to work up a premeditated plan for acting out on that? A couple minutes. Okay, we've got some hot-headed, aggressive people here. There's no doubt about it. They are people who get the job done. So if killing is what you need done today, maybe you want to see Brother Jim, Brother Mike, and they can get her done for you. All right, it's good we all come here for one reason or another, right? Do you have business cards to hand out afterwards?
Why did you say you call them out of the garden? Where are you getting that from?
There's still direct communication.
I think it's something we have said, human nature says, if God would just speak to me, I would do such and such, and we would say, I would obey. God's speaking to him, and look what happened.
Look how many people pray about what's already in here.
Yeah.
I need prayer. God's not going to sit there and repeat himself. Read the book. No, you're not going to hear an answer. Why? It's in the book. Now, maybe he does talk to those certain few who have these certain, like, way out there ideas about some sort of thing for whatever reason may not be in here. But other than that, it's in here. You don't need to pray about it. Do what's in here. And later on, well, you're going to go through all the four?
I'm going to try to.
Okay.
All right, so then the Lord says to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? All right, we'll move on. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother? I don't know, he replied, am I my brother's keeper? Very famous line. Now, here's the interesting thing. So, Cain offers God a sacrifice, and God says, there's something about you and your sacrifice, it's not quite right. I'd like you to rethink this, and you have some time to think about it. What's Cain's response? In the end, Cain's response is to sacrifice to himself. What does he sacrifice to himself? My brother is worthy of being sacrificed to appease my anger. So Cain's anger is appeased by the sacrifice of his brother Abel. And at that moment, what Cain has set himself up as is lord of his own life and lord of his domain.
Well, maybe this part explains the first part.
Which is?
Why was this sacrifice better than this sacrifice? Mark?
Yeah, oh, no question about it. There's something going on here.
But not there. Cain's heart was different than Abel's heart. He had a different heart.
All right. Now, I don't want to spend, I'm trying to give a little backstory here, but the parts that we need to focus on are yet ahead. All right. I don't know, he replied, am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you were under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops to you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. Now, here is Cain's summation of this. This is how Cain understands, and God doesn't rebuff him on this, this is how Cain understands what has been pronounced over him. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is more than I can bear. Today I have been driven from the land, and I have been hidden from your presence. So these are the two things that he believes from this moment on he's experiencing. God is no longer for me. God is actually against me, and I'm being driven from everything that I have that was mine, and I'm going to be a wanderer. Now here's the interesting thing. As we move ahead, let me see if I can get to this so we can sum this up pretty quickly. All right. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Ariad, and Ariad was the father of, well, we get on with all them. Anyway, Lamech married two women. One was Adah, and the other was Zilpah. Adah gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock, an entire industry birthed out of that family. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Educated, cultured, sophisticated. Zilpah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze. Here's the interesting thing. No such reference is made to the other side of the family. So there, Adam and Eve have another son. No mention is made of them developing technologies, becoming advanced in certain ways. And here's what I believe. Somehow it seems as if the people of God have separated themselves from the best of the artistic nature of what is available to do on earth. Meanwhile, the people without God seem to do the technological stuff, the creative stuff. And my question here is, do we need a bridge person? Do we need a person, and does such a kind of person who exists, who has one foot in the kingdom and one foot on the planet, and can bridge the gap and be the representative that pulls the two sides back together? And if so, do we find any evidence of that in the Bible? So let's turn over for a moment to 1 Peter 2:9.
We have some people today, but unfortunately some of us have been criticized by people supposedly on our side.
First Peter 2:9. It's not like you're going to be surprised when you get there and you're going to say, oh, I've never read that. It's not that at all. Actually, you're probably there already. So when I get there. That is exactly the point that I didn't get to, okay? That is actually the point that I didn't get to. Thank you. That represents the third circle. Because God is with them out here. It seems that there's almost a presence out here. But when they are driven out even further, it's like now people have to reach back to God. People are out here. God is here somewhere, and there is no link, there is no bridge between the two, and so people start to devise ways of connecting with God or reaching out to God because God's presence doesn't seem to be there. And that, I am so glad you said that, because I forgot that. That was the whole point to this. We need a bridge type of people. Now, back to the Peter verse.
Where are we at? 1 Peter 1?
2:9. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of Him who called you out of darkness and into His wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So this is, dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world. Are you posing a question for discussion or asking specifically because you're unclear? I'm not sure which, how to understand your question.
Discussion.
Okay.
What did the garden provide?
Well, what do you think it provided?
Well, it didn't provide amusement. It provided food, shelter, didn't eat clothing, weren't embarrassed. Food and shelter. Now.
It provided something more, actually, but go ahead.
Okay, but God shows up there, right? God's there, provides there's fellowship, there's you know, people think that He's supposed to provide cars, houses, good college, like all this other stuff.
Okay, hold on to that for a minute. You asked, what does the garden provide? The garden provides another thing. The garden was a prototype of what the whole earth was to be like, ultimately. Once humankind understood how to care for this garden and understood how it worked, they were to be immersed in their work. And once they understood how that worked, they could take the garden model of fellowship and stewardship and start to spread it out across the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world was a huge waste. And their charge to ultimately be fruitful and multiply would have meant a really overpopulated garden. Right? They couldn't ultimately have fulfilled their mandate if they stayed in the garden. So the job of the garden was to provide a nurturing environment just like you would with children. Just like your family of origin is intended to be a nurturing environment that prepares you for success on your own outside that family. Now, if you're still living at home in your parents' basement and you're 40, then maybe something has failed about that. But
and
kicked out of the garden.
But also, if they came, they come along, you understand. If the world's already broken, they come along. So you don't have to wonder why Cain kills Abel. He's broken.
Okay.
Also has the knowledge of all the people.
So here's the question. Who is going to step into that gap? Who is going to step into that gap between God and what He would desire for people, and between us, who are pursuing a lot of important stuff, but we're pursuing it sometimes as a substitute for God? Don't miss that. If a person doesn't have God, then other things in their life become what they crave and worship. And we all have artificial gods in our lives. Make no mistake about it. It's not like the day you become a believer in Christ, you all of a sudden displace all of your idols and you have no more idols for the rest of your life. Right? If we were to take an honest inventory, there's probably not a person in this room who doesn't have some idol tucked away in some corner of their life. Something that they worship. Something that they like. Something that they crave. And something that we'd almost sacrifice their relationship with God in a small way over. I know we don't like to think that, but it's probably true. So, again, how do we become these priests? Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like us to turn over to now. Which time do we have? Yeah, it's probably good. Let's go over to Psalm 37.
Psalm 37.
You'll just give me a minute to get there because I kind of forgot after I told you where we were going. So. Yes. Perfect. Alright, remember the list from the beginning? What we need to do if we're going to pass on what we hold dear to the next generation? Give me the 4-point list. And act on. That's what we want people to do. And the whole question that needs to stick with us is, how do we make that happen? How do we do that? And so while I was driving back from, I guess it was Atlanta last Sunday, incidentally, you're getting the second-rate version of the best presentation that I gave, which was to myself in the car last Sunday. So I'm sorry that this presentation isn't as good as that one. But well, the people that drive by me probably think I am, yes, but that's... Okay, we're going to start at the beginning, but we're going to start with this premise. This is more than just a worship song. This is David, who has some ideas that he wants to share with people. Do not fret because of evil men. Do not be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. All right, what's the issue that he's addressing? Let's flesh that out a little bit. What is he seeing that people might be tempted to do, those who are going to go after him?
People might be attracted to evil worship.
Okay. Or, if they're not drawn to it, what might they be? Nervous because of it. In other words, I might decide that this way of living is not the right way to live. I'm going to go after what the evil people do. And that's what John is saying. Or, I might live my life in fear because of what they might do. Now, I want you to think about how effective you can be as a priest if you're nervous about what the rest of the world is going to do. Can you be an effective spokesperson to the people that you want to reach if you're extremely nervous about what they're going to think or what they might do to you? And the answer is no. Because you're going to measure every single word based not on what's good for them, but based on what's good for you. Now, we can see this made clear, and I'm going to come back to verse 2, but we can see this made clear in verse number 3. Trust in the Lord and do good, dwell in the land, enjoy safe pasture. What's the opposite of dwelling in the land? Yes, it is. It's leaving the land. Okay, now let's make this sort of figurative. What happens if you are appointed? Remember, you're this person with a foot on earth and a foot in the kingdom. You are a man of heaven, but a man also of the earth. Sound like anybody else you've ever read about? Okay, you are a man of both kingdoms. What happens if you tremble and live in fear and decide to move? If you don't dwell, if you don't live richly in the land, but instead you move, what happens to everyone that you could influence?
Well, I think you said that perfectly, because if you're straddling the line and you move at all, you're living in one or the other. You're not, you know what I mean? You're straddling.
Great illustration. So I can be drawn fully into the world in that role, or I can be drawn fully into the quote kingdom of heaven where I think I'm doing good, but I'm actually doing no good because I all spent all my time over here.
A double-minded man. That's what that is. Unstable all his ways. Or talking about one securely in God's faithfulness.
Or so has to be, you know, work as though it's good.
All right, now.
If he cannot speak relevantly, but he knows this book inside and out, but cannot speak relevantly.
Oh, absolutely. He is absolutely worthless, and that would offend some people. Right? It's why we spend so much time here talking about life issues. I need to introduce Scripture at the right time in the right way. Study the words of Jesus, and you will see that there is a great deal of teaching that is just practical teaching that is connected to the people where they are and the way they are. He is not beating them over the head consistently with Scripture. He understands the Scripture, but he delivers the message in language that they will understand, which very often isn't Scripture directly. All right, come back up to verse 2. For like the grass, they will soon wither, and like green plants, they will soon die away. Now you see that terminology used several times in the Scripture. Why? Well, why did that matter to those people? Okay, so would that really connect with you today? Do you spend your time as an agronomist studying plants most of the time? I mean, frankly, for most of us, when we look at our grass, we'd like if it would wither and die, right? Because it would mean we'd have less cutting cycles. Am I the only one, or what? Okay, and they're going to get that. Here's my question. What is the current day analogy or metaphor that you would need to use if you were going to communicate to your children or to those in your workplace that you don't want to go the way of the evil person? Now think about this. This has very practical implications. So the board is tempted. Do we go this way or do we go that way? The contractor is tempted. Do we take this shortcut or do we lose money right now and just bite the bullet and rip this thing out and redo it because it's defective and we discovered it's defective? Do we leave the bridge stay this way or do we fix the defect? This is not just David in Bible times. You and I, on an everyday basis, face this challenge. If you are going to be the person who has a foot in both kingdoms, how do you communicate in the language of your workplace or your family place in ways that the people whom you're communicating with will get? What's the metaphor that you need to use? And I can't tell you that. That's your job to figure it out. This is where, as a united priesthood, and notice Peter does not refer to them just as individual priests. He calls us what? A priesthood. Which means that even within that priesthood, there are going to be fields of specialty. So you're going to be good at the technical aspect of something. Somebody else might be great at the communication side of it. But as a priesthood, we become a community of people with one foot in each kingdom. Didn't you have your hand up?
No.
You sure? And we can make those connections happen.
Step out of the way, know that I'm beyond my communication skills, and let them talk and remove myself from it. I don't have to. Am I going to say no?
All right. Let's come back here. I want you to turn over to the back side of your first page, right down at the bottom. And I want us to look, as we're reading through this psalm, here's the main point of what we're going through right now. It is to study this psalm or any other like that and say, what does poetry offer that helps us to understand how to communicate well? Now, I know most of us don't think of ourselves as poets. Most of us would not want to be poets. That sounds a little bit, I don't know, just not like what we want to do. That's just, there's other words that come to mind, but we're not going to use them here. So we're just going to say that doesn't sound like something we might want to do. But actually, how many of us would aspire to be a man sort of like David? Right? There's a lot of noble qualities in David. There's a lot of masculine qualities in David. And yet David was also a great communicator, typifying the man with a foot in both worlds. Okay, so what does poetry do? Makes an idea interesting to consider. Of the 4 points that we talked about that I erased from the board earlier, remember I asked you to repeat them, of the 4 points, what one does this address? Will I receive it? Right? Makes an idea interesting to consider. If it bores me, why do I have to go to church? It's not relevant to me. If it bores me, I don't even want to consider it. So the first job of poetry is to disarm a person and help them to at least listen to the thing. Okay. Adds insights or additional ways to look at something. All right. Just like that illustration in verse 2. It's an illustration. The grass withers. It passes away. What's the real message there? What's David saying in poetic form that he wants future generations? And that's his target. He already knows this stuff. Remember that. David is not reciting this for his own understanding. He's passing this understanding on to other people so that it doesn't die in him.
Spiritual philosophy turns it into this picture.
There you go. And what is the spiritual philosophy?
Stay rooted in the source of life.
Okay, stay rooted in the source of life is one. What's another one?
Acknowledge our own brokenness.
Acknowledge our own brokenness. Well, come on. Don't fret over the way of the evil person, because in the end, it's going to reveal their own destruction, not yours. It might take a while. How does he know this? He's done it. He's speaking out of the depth of his own experience, but he doesn't want to bore people with... Right? He could recite his own history. Let me tell you about this story. Let me tell you about that story. Let me tell you about the other story. He's not sure his hearers want to hear all his stories. So he just uses a general purpose metaphor. This is what's going to happen to them sooner or later. Rely on it. All right, the next point, number 3, makes a principle more memorable. Right? This grass withers and fades away thing, it's become part of the lingo of a lot of believers throughout centuries. Right? It's a simple phrase, but think about how much it captures, even for people who don't worry about grass all day long and don't care about flowers and all that. Says a lot with a little. Right? So how long would it take to say what I just said about don't fret and worry? It took me 3 or 4 minutes to say it. David said it in a single verse. Remember the example we used of Vinny earlier? What was it? He moved from hits to hugs. He condensed an entire philosophy about what was going to be different in his life in the future in a single phrase. I'm going to move from hits to hugs. And it disarms my resistance.
The challenge with that is not everybody has a charismatic curve with their words. So it would behoove us to find those people in our circle, IG fellowship, that can do that, that are able to preach to them.
It is true. And yet, let me bring us back to this. We are different. Remember, I think it was week 2, we said that a leader has to observe, evaluate, ideate, in other words, come up with ideas about how to address this situation the way it is. Does anybody remember the next one? It was communicate. And then finally take action. Every one of those, I said, was a non-negotiable in the end. One way or another, if you wish to lead others, you have to find your voice.
David was a warrior. How did he become a poet?
I believe his poetry started when he was young, just observing things. You can see that in many of the Psalms that are written. They have to do with the outdoors. They have to do with sheep. Later on, he takes some of those skills that he developed when he was young and he applies them to things that he's learned along the way. But that started early on in his life.
How important do you think knowledge was to David? Consider what happened.
So, how important was knowledge?
Knowledge. Reading.
Oh, I think probably important.
David also was told he was disqualified from doing God's work.
Why?
He couldn't build the temple because of what he thought.
But David laid out the plans for Jerusalem. He laid out the plans for his palace. He laid out the plans to start of the temple, and then he disqualified himself. So David, all that was in him. It was there.
Okay, we'll move on.
Still on that
What's that?
David passed on that knowledge.
Both in writing and in word to his own people. So, yeah, the frustrating part about this is, honestly, and we should take a lesson from this. He did a great job of passing stuff on so that 2,000 years later, almost 3,000 years later, we have access to his thinking. Just think about that. Thousands of years later, we have access to the thoughts that were going on in this guy's mind. And yet, here's a guy that is equally renowned for failing his own family.
There were several.
Now just let that settle in. The man who was able to pass information down for generations didn't seem to take enough time to pass the information on to the next generation. And from even a very political sense, remember week one, we looked at how fast the empire unraveled. How fast that all came undone. So Solomon, his progeny, starts. Solomon takes the kingdom to its pinnacle and also heads it on the trajectory towards the very bottom.
Even before that, David had another son, Absalom. What happened there?
So let's not miss this. This is difficult to deal with. As a matter of fact, if there's one sort of like subplot going on in the scripture that's relevant to what we're talking about right now, this book is packed with examples of people who were great public leaders but weren't great private leaders. And that their public life was successful, but their family life in one way or another was a failure, and they thought the public life was more important because it feels more important. But a generation out, the public was feeling the results of the private failure, and that's the message. If you spend too much time developing your public life and influencing now, your private life is going to be the next generation, and it might unleash things you didn't expect. I know you're anxious to talk. Go ahead. What? So all I'm saying is, make sure that you have some sort of a balance, because it seems that we can get out of balance. And remember when we told the story, went through the story series, and I said that one of the stories that we frequently tell ourselves is that we're an exception. You're not an exception. Right? You're not an exception. The scriptures prove that you're not an exception in the fact that you can have public victory and private failure, and the private failure will sooner or later become a public failure in a future generation. Okay. Let's return to the text. I want to make sure that we got through this list first. So we're looking at what poetry provides. It says a lot with a little. Makes difficult to hear ideas more palatable. In other words, it works around your existence by going in the back door. So while you're guarding the front door so you don't let this information in that you don't want to get into your life, this metaphor sneaks in the back door and you're attracted to it, and all of a sudden it's inside of you before you realized it was in you. And then the final thing, it expands our outlook, because sometimes a good metaphor takes us to places that we couldn't have seen and appreciated without it. Now we'll return to the psalm. All right, we'll jump down a little bit. Let's say verse 8. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil, for evil men will be cut off. So it's a two-step reminder. If you dwell on these things that make you angry, it's going to start to get inside your psyche and cause you to think in different ways. And the result is, sooner or later, you're going to become one of these evil people that I was just talking about a little bit a while ago, and it's going to happen to you. Don't think that you're exempt from what could happen to evil people just because you used to be on the right path. Incidentally, coming back to the idea about your son, there's only two places, there's only two institutions where most people learn any kind of a general moral and ethical foundation: the church and the home. You're not going to learn it in school. So when your son says to you, "I don't see why I should go here," let's think about how practical this is. Let's read verse 8 together again. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to anger, to evil. Do you know a guy in your life that lets anger get the best of them on a regular basis? Do you know a person who has allowed anger to cause them to do things that later on they say, "Geez, I regret that"? Can you see that person? We all know somebody like that. The Proverbs go so far as to say, just stay away from the person who gets like that, because it's so infectious and contagious, you'll get like that. Where else are you going to hear this if you don't hear it in the church and the home? This is not just, oh, you need to come learn about Jesus in a cute little picture. No, this stuff will save your life, and that's why you need to learn it. And apparently I'm too excited. Sorry.
That's good. That's true. We keep you from ruin, from destruction. Yeah.
Isn't that just on our own?
So when you're a leader at this level, and there's lots of other people around you, there's people with you. But when you get to the point where David was when he's looking at Bathsheba, he's already at the pinnacle. And what you're saying is he had not surrounded himself with people at the level that he had arrived at. He had outgrown perhaps some of the people that he was with formerly, but he hadn't invested in developing the right kinds of counselors later on to share the elevated position that he had. So he'd invested in his external war, but perhaps at that moment had not invested enough in his internal war.
We just need to know
that. Yeah, but almost to push back a little bit on what you said, how long did it take for all that to transpire? He just walked up on his roof, right? It wasn't like when he walked up the steps to his rooftop, he was saying, well, I hope there's some hot-looking naked babe on the roof next door. I mean, that's not what was going on in his mind.
I was clicking through the computer and it popped up. Oops.
Then you stayed there.
I heard a story one time. It was about a couple of hours of dinner. The mom gets a frantic call on the phone. It's the kid. He's about 12, 13 years old. And he's frantically banging away on the keys. Something popped up and it kept popping up. He was doing something. Maybe it was nefarious. Maybe it wasn't. And she was trying to explain to him how to fix it. Dad said, give me the phone. Got on the phone. Pull the plug out of the wall. What are you doing? You're running the place. Knock it off.
Okay, the reality is that there are times when we're not going to have someone next to us. Let's not be too hard on David. Yeah, I mean, it spiraled way out of control. But remember, for those of us who are going to pass judgment on David, we don't have access to the kinds of privilege that David had access to. Okay, you can't hire somebody to kill the guy whose wife you just slept with. David could. Right, you can't knock on the neighbor's door when the wife is there and say, the king summons you to his palace. Right, so before we're really hard on David, let's understand we don't have quite the clout that David had. But we still have the same heart of a man that David had. Just remember that. I'm just saying, so let's not be... All right, so here's what I'm going to do. So I attempt to get through the final point of this outline. I want you, this is your homework, read Psalm 37. Look for every great illustration you can find. And what it will, I gave you that list of six things. All right, we're going to go to the back page so that I try to get you out of here on time. And the idea is to understand those things that are most important and need to be communicated. If you were to reflect back on your life experience for the last 30 days, how much important communication did you do, and how much trivial communication did you do? Now, I'm not opposed to trivial communication. We all just need to unwind, talk about, I don't know, I can't imagine this, but some people talk about sports. I just don't get that. But, whatever it is that you like to talk about, there's nothing, I mean, that's helpful, it's decompressing, it's de-stressing, and it's all that. But what kinds of useful conversation are you having that are passing ideas along to people that need to know them? As I look around this room, apart from maybe John here, who seems young, and Pat's sort of young. Well, you're a little young. Your hair's pretty black yet, isn't it? That's good. That's good, yeah. There's at least a few grays in the hair, which means that we're more experienced at life. Your days are limited. My days are limited. I was really struck by this last night. I'm trying to go to sleep and I'm thinking, who do I want to make sure that understands the things that I know before I die? I mean, I know that's a morbid thought to go to sleep with, but I was actually thinking about that when I went to sleep. It was the premise of the opening thing. Who are the people in my life that I want to make sure get the things that I have spent a lifetime getting to understand before I die? Because remember the premise, whatever you don't share dies with you. All right. So here's the thing. Suppose you had a collection of cars. I want you to think about cars. You've got a lot of cars. You've got two choices. You can put the cars in a garage, and we know people who do this, and they're for your sight only. You collect cars, you amass them, you park them in garages, you build more garages as you buy more cars, and you acquire a great collection of cars. Who benefits? Maybe your heirs later on when they sell it, right? But that's the only way they benefit, because they probably weren't interested in cars, so they wouldn't have built the collection by themselves. So the only way that they benefit is to sell the car collection and take the proceeds. But what if you were to take those great collectible cars and you were to put them in a museum so that they could be enjoyed and appreciated by others?
Or those mannequins.
See, that's my illustration. They're made to be driven. That plane's made to be flown.
When we had the red solstice, right? The red platinum car.
Well, there you go. Loops around the parking lot on Jimmy afterwards. Could you see a person storing 1980s Hondas and Toyotas in that museum? Not on purpose. And you certainly wouldn't want to display them for others, right? Nobody would show up to see them. So here's the first question. What are you storing? What are you spending your time curating? What are you spending your time focusing on and sharing with others? Do you have a bunch of Toyotas coming out of your mouth all the time? Or do you have some classic pieces that you want to display? Listen, I'm not anti-Japanese car. I'm sure there's some great ones out there. I know there are. All right? That's why I prefaced it by saying 1980s. It wasn't that funny. Really, it wasn't that funny. All right. Here's the principle. The next principle. There are things that are valuable that we take for granted. How many of you have ever taken a cup of coffee, got it somewhere, put it in your car for a road trip? Why do you do that? Well, see, what you do is you are living out an understanding that you have that you've never quite articulated this way. You have coffee in abundance at your home, or coffee in abundance at the Starbucks. You can have as many cups as you want. Is coffee valuable to you? Yes. Otherwise, you wouldn't have stopped there. But coffee is in abundance there. How much coffee is in your car? I mean, unless you spill it, right? Unless you spill it, how much coffee is in your car? Only that which you take with you. Okay. Work with me here. Is air valuable? Oh, you say eh. Air is valuable and common, which is why, even though it is crucial to life and we couldn't live without it, we take it for granted. Now, I want you to hear this. There are things in your life that are so common to you in the way of wisdom that you don't even realize that they're uncommon anymore. Your mission... Okay, now we'll do some diving, okay? How necessary is air when you're diving? It's so necessary that because there's not enough of it below the surface for you, you take it with you. Because the only way you're going to have some of it when you get there is if you brought it along. Did you want to say something quick? This had better not have anything to do with starfish, or I'm cutting you off. I'm just telling you. Okay, well, and this is why I use the illustration of air. There are things that are indispensable to living a successful life that the next generation needs to know that you understand so well that you take it for granted and no longer think it has value. Put that piece of wisdom in a different context and it makes all the difference in the world. See, we live in a culture of wisdom right here. Don't take it for granted that everywhere you go that same level of wisdom and understanding is present, because it's not. And so our job as people with a foot in the kingdom of heaven and a foot on planet Earth, our job is to be those purveyors of that seemingly to us abundant but yet incredibly valuable information and wisdom. It's our job to bridge the gap between what we know and the people who don't yet know it. All right, I think that pretty much wraps it up for me today.